From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Atlantic Monthly essayist Benjamin Schwartz says, don't be seduced by talk of peace in the Middle East. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, he says, is a problem without solution. But it will have an outcome, he says, most likely produced by an explosive Palestinian birth rate. Israeli Jews are on their way to being overwhelmed by simple demographics, says Benjamin Schwartz. Will Israel live to 100? He suggests not. Tonight on Point, a no-peace future for Israelis and Palestinians, and maybe one day, no Israel. We begin tonight in Jerusalem. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon will travel to Crawford, Texas, Monday for conversations with President Bush. The meeting comes as Sharon pushes forward his plan for unilateral withdrawal of Israeli settlers from the Gaza Strip. Yesterday, Sharon met with settlers there to try to convince them to leave their homes peacefully. On the other side of the conflict, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has hit a rough patch. Last week, Al-Aqsa Brigade Palestinian gunmen opened fire around his own headquarters. John Anderson is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him what agenda Ariel Sharon will bring to President Bush's ranch in Crawford.
First of all, you have to take a look at the symbolism of the event. The Israelis, I think, are very excited to actually be invited to the ranch because this is a place where most world leaders don't end up. It's only Bush's pals who show up at the ranch, and I think this underscores what Israel believes is their special relationship that has evolved between the United States and Israel under this president. I think what they're looking for and what they're probably likely to get is a reaffirmation from President Bush of what he's said publicly and in letters to Ariel Sharon in the past, which is that in the years ahead, Israel is, at least the U.S. position, is that Israel is not going to have to withdraw to 1967 boundaries whenever it is that they end up with a final peace accord. That's very important to Israel because they've got 240,000 settlers who are in the West Bank, and they don't want to have to remove all those settlers from the West Bank in any final peace accord. So I think one of the main things they're looking for, and there's been a lot of confusion about what the U.S. position is a clear statement that they're not going to have to remove all those settlers from the West Bank in any final peace accord.
Now, just in the last couple of weeks, there have been moves on that front. Sharon sanctioning an expansion of settlements near Jerusalem, but in the West Bank. Washington objecting to that. Is President Bush going to be asking Ariel Sharon to turn around on that expansion? That, is, as far as I understand, is not in line with official U.S. position.
You know, that's, if there's going to be a bone of contention that's going to show up in this meeting, that's it. It's the expansion of something called the E1 settlement, and I guess Americans might call it infill. It's an infill development between a major settlement east of Jerusalem and an area that's barren in between that settlement and Jerusalem. They want to infill it with development, and Israel has approved plans for about 3,500 houses to be placed in that area to create a continuity between Mali Adumim, which is the largest settlement in the West Bank, and Jerusalem. Palestinians object to this violently, vigorously, vehemently, because it effectively closes a door for the northern part of the West Bank, for Palestinians in the northern part of the West Bank, to get into East Jerusalem, which they hope to make their future capital. And this is, as I said, one of the big bones of contention is, you know, the question of whether or not the U.S. is going to agree that Israel can go ahead and do this development, because the roadmap peace plan that President Bush has endorsed and that the U.S. helped draft says that there will be no expansion of settlements in the West Bank. And, you know, the bottom line here is that I think what they're going to be looking for, I know what the Israelis are looking for, and the question is whether or not the Americans are going to give it to them, is sort of a deliberate ambiguity, a statement that different people can interpret different ways that allows settlement to go forward on the one hand, but gives people cover to say, well, that's not the expansion we were talking about on the other. That effectively allows Israel to claim that they're following the letter of the law, but not really follow the spirit of it.
As you say, John, this has outraged Palestinians, but is it intended in part by Prime Minister Sharon to mollify Israelis upset with his unilateral withdrawal plans from Gaza?
Absolutely no doubt about that, and he's been quite clear about that, I think, too, that the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza comes as a package with what Sharon believes are U.S. agreements that allow Israel to tighten its grip on settlement blocks in the West Bank. These are large settlements like Mali Adumim, like Ariel, north of Mali Adumim, that stretch deep into the West Bank, large blocks of settlements that Israel does not want to relinquish under any circumstances. I mean, these are effectively large, very large towns, almost cities, with massive amounts of infrastructure, high levels of population that Israel doesn't want to give back. And Sharon's plan, his game plan, apparently, was give up Gaza, but hold on to these huge settlement blocks in the West Bank.
Now, stepping back from those for just a second, Mahmoud Abbas is at the head of the Palestinians now. Arafat is gone. High expectations in recent months that this would clear the way for a more open conversation between Israel and the Palestinians. Is that happening?
No, it's not happening. And, you know, nobody, as usual in these protracted peace dances that they do here, nobody has lived up to their expectations. Abbas has not consolidated the Palestinian security forces as he had promised. He has not gone out and arrested wanted militants who are in areas that are now under Palestinian control. He's not disarmed Palestinian militant groups, Hamas and Islamic Jihad. The Palestinians say, on the other hand, well, Sharon hasn't done enough either to help support Abbas. And I think that's one of the things that President Bush is probably going to try and do with Prime Minister Sharon when he's down in Crawford, Texas, is twist his arm a little bit and say, look, can't we give a little bit more to Mahmoud Abbas? Can't we give more to Abu Mazen to try and boost his credibility with the Palestinians? Can't we look at possibly releasing a few more Palestinian prisoners? Can't we look at, you know, turning over security control in a few more West Bank towns to the Palestinians? Can't we remove a few of these roadblocks and checkpoints that are out there in the West Bank? There, you know, at last count, there were more than 700 of them. Can't we remove some of those to show the Palestinian people that Abbas is delivering on his promises and that he's a good leader and that they should support him?
So the conversation hasn't developed as expected. What about the aura of optimism that was there after Yasser Arafat's death, after Abbas took office? Is that still there on either side, on both sides?
You know, it's sort of, it's very gradually dissipating. It's not plummeting off the edge of a cliff, but I think everybody is enjoying, you know, a couple of months of silence here and wondering how long that can go on without significant dialogue and significant initiatives percolating up from it. I would not say that there's a high level of optimism here. I think people are basically hoping that somehow the disengagement plan can be coordinated with the Palestinians, that Mahmoud Abbas can somehow flex his muscle and get a grip on the security situation out in the West Bank, and that Hamas becoming involved along with Islamic Jihad more in the electoral process and participating in elections will signify that they're starting to lay down their weapons and become political participants instead of leaning on violence to get their ends. Everybody's sort of waiting to see how all these issues evolve, and nobody really knows right now. But I would not say that anybody's, you know, overly optimistic about it.
Not exactly the springtime for peace that was so much hoped for. John Anderson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
John Anderson is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. We are talking tonight about the likely shape of a future without peace for Israelis and Palestinians. You can join the conversation. Do you feel renewed hope today for peace in the Middle East? Are you fed up with gloom and doom scenarios or afraid they might be right? And what about Israel's future? Can it, will it last without peace? How? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Joining me now from Pasadena, California, is Benjamin Schwartz. He's an editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine and former foreign policy analyst at the Rand Corporation. His article, Will Israel Live to 100, is in the Atlantic's current issue. Benjamin Schwartz, good evening and welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's great to have you. So here you've got a provocative headline and a long essay to back it up, and you come to a rather grim conclusion, really grim for both sides. What's the case you're making, Benjamin?
Well, I think from Israel's founding, it's really been vexed by the issues of demography and geography. When Jews first came to Palestine, they were a very small minority. And essentially, their mission, the mission in founding the State of Israel, was to make an Arab land into a Jewish state. For Israel was able to do that until the 67 war, when, of course, it took over large parts of Jordan and the Gaza Strip. Over the years, the Arab population in those areas has grown much faster than at a much faster rate than the Jewish population of Israel proper. So we're at a point now where demographers debate whether, in fact, in the land between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, there is a Jewish majority or an Arab majority.
In question when you count the population on the West Bank.
That's right, and in the Gaza Strip. Mm-hmm. So, and certainly, that situation within a year at most is going to change, and that there's going to, in fact, be an Arab majority between the Mediterranean and the Jordan.
Within a year from now?
Yeah. A lot of demographers think that's already happened.
But, of course, that's not the state of Israel. That's Israel
exactly.
Plus occupied territories.
Israel, yes. Now, but when that happens, Israelis fear, correctly, that there'll be more and more pressure within the Palestinian community, not for a separate Palestinian state, but just essentially for one man, one vote. All right, you're not going to give the Palestinian position would be fine. You don't want to give us a Palestinian state. Then let us participate in the democratic process.
And the meaning of that for Israel?
Well, a lot of people say that would be sort of a South Africa. I mean, Israel would be pressured between sort of a South Africa solution, that is sort of apartheid, and giving in to the Palestinian demands, which would mean the end of a Jewish state.
You describe it as more or less the end of Israel. Benjamin Schwartz, stand by. We're talking tonight about a no-peace future for Israel and the Palestinians, and maybe one day no Israel. You can join the conversation. Can Israel and the Palestinians really and truly reach an accommodation? And if they cannot, who wins and who loses what? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a no-peace future for Israel and the Palestinians, a future where compromise fails. My guest is Benjamin Schwartz. He's an editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. His essay in the magazine this month is headlined, Will Israel Live to 100? And the conclusion he reaches is not very sanguine on that front. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you think? Can Israel live to 100 without peace with the Palestinians? And given the demographics, the Arab birth rate, does no peace ultimately mean no Israel? Is this a problem without a solution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Benjamin Schwartz, Israel founded 1948. That means 2048, where you're banding around the idea of no Israel. That is not an unimaginable distance away. So I can imagine people scratching their heads and saying, all right, let's get more concrete here. What do you actually mean? You've essentially portrayed two scenarios here. One where somehow, you say against all odds, there is a peace deal. And you say even then, the prospects are bleak here. The other, you say more likely, no deal. Play the two of those out for us. How does it actually happen that the specter of no Israel materially emerges?
Okay, well, let's assume that there is some kind of peace deal and that there is a Palestinian state formed in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
This is the two-state solution.
Yes, a two-state solution.
Which Washington supports and has occasionally pushed for.
That's right. Even if that comes to pass, by 2050, Israeli Arabs will make up about 30% of the population of Israel proper. That is, Israel even without the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
So I see, inside Israel proper, okay, 30%.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's a sizable minority that would put a lot of pressure on the Israeli democracy. It would make Israeli rule in Israel proper difficult.
Israeli rule or Jewish rule?
Jewish rule. Mm-hmm. That's right. Now, the more important part of this, though, is the pressures that Palestinians in the Palestinian state would be under. Again, Palestinian birth rates are extremely high. You will have an enormous number of people in a very fast-growing population in an area that really cannot support that population. Now, the natural place for many of those people to go, at least for many of them to seek employment, would be Israel. But for obvious reasons, Israelis would have to severely restrict the right of Palestinians to work in Israel. You have an extremely small piece of land between the Mediterranean and the Jordan. It's probably not large enough and doesn't have the natural resources, even in terms of something like water, to support two states.
So you see, even in what we think of as the best case scenario, two-state solution, an agreement on that, difficult as that may be, that the Palestinians eventually kind of burst out of their borders or their resources. Even if Israel and the world come in with all kinds of aid and help build a real pumping economy there?
Well, that will take a lot of doing. And again, when as the Palestinian population grows, and as the demographic and economic and natural resource pressures intensify, a lot of Palestinians will ask themselves, well, why are we, I mean, what's the magic of this 1967 border? The 1967 border, after all, is not the border that was agreed in the UN partition that founded the State of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And many Israelis, in fact, fear this, that there'll be a gradual, that whatever deal is made now will not be the final deal, that Palestinians then will come back with more demands.
And that is in what we think of as the best case scenario. Perhaps there's a rosier way that could play out, but as you see it. Now, mm-hmm. in the no peace deal scenario, be concrete about how you see that unfolding. We see the demographic trends, that is, very high birth rates outside the Jewish community. But Israel is a very potent military power. Could it not just entrench, build the fence, build the walls, build up the military strength, and hang in there, regardless of what happens with the demographics?
Well, yeah, it could. But the question is, what kind of international support would Israel receive? I don't know how many Americans, for instance, would be comfortable supporting what would be considered in the eyes of many in the world to be essentially a South African-type state. In other words, a state in which Jews rule Jews rule a population that is majority Arab. Now, they would rule it either, I mean, even if the Arabs are not properly in Israel, it is still land that would be governed and administered or occupied by the Israelis. From the Palestinian point of view, all they would be demanding is one man, one vote. So I think it would be extremely difficult for America's Israeli supporters to make a very strong case that Israel was still a democracy.
You know how much passion there is among Israelis, among American Jews and others for the Israeli project. And yet you quote Israelis saying, patriots all, wistfully saying, we should have taken Uganda. What do you mean? What are they talking about? And what does
that indicate? They're referring to the British offer the Zionist leadership in 1903, a chunk of East Africa for a Jewish homeland, for Uganda. It's remarkable. I mean, Israelis of any... I'm an historically minded guy, and it's wonderful to be in Israel because Israelis know their history, they're always talking about their past. They know it extremely well. What they mean by that is essentially, this is a very dangerous and complicated part of the world. This is a more dangerous neighborhood than Jews probably assumed it would have been. And also, again, you know, the Zionist slogan was land for a people a people without land in a land without people. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that was disregarding the fact that Palestinians were in Israel. You were essentially implanting a foreign population in a place that already had an indigenous population. So it introduces an enormous number of difficulties.
So will Israel live to 100? That takes us to 2048. If you had to pull up your crystal ball, what do you see, Benjamin Schwartz? 2048.
Well, again, there's a question mark after that headline.
There is, but a powerful suggestion running throughout your essay.
No, certainly. Israel, I think Israel will be around in 2048, but it will be besieged and isolated state. And whether Israel will be around 30 years after that date, I think the answer is probably no.
Wow. What a picture. Given all the history that we've been through, given all the investment of dreams and passion there. We're talking tonight with Benjamin Schwartz. He's an editor and essayist at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. His new article is Will Israel Live to 100? He's former executive editor of the World Policy Journal. It's a publication of the World Policy Institute at the New School University, former foreign policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. You can join us. Can you imagine Israel receding as an ideal, as a fact, under the weight of Palestinian numbers, if nothing else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. John is calling from Chicago. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I want to challenge a statement that Mr. Schwartz has made.
Okay.
And this gets back to your comparisons between Israel and South Africa, which I think is a completely inappropriate comparison in many ways. Your statement that the Palestinians are simply asking for one man, one vote, and that that alone will lead to the demographic shift which will threaten the state of Israel. First of all, the Arabs that live in Israel right now, which is about 20% of the population, they already have a vote.
Mm-hmm.
They currently vote in Israeli elections. They are represented in Israeli parliament.
So there's nothing South African there. That's full democratic representation.
And furthermore, the Palestinians living in the West Bank already have a vote in their own elections. This is not a question of voting rights.
Benjamin Schwartz, John's challenging the parallel you've drawn between a potential parallel emerging between Israel and South Africa. How do you defend that?
Well, first, I'm not comparing Israel to South Africa. I'm saying that there are many Palestinians who compare Israel to South Africa. I'm also saying that in the eyes of the world community, a situation in which the Israeli state, that is a Jewish state, rules over an Arab majority, a non-Jewish majority, is a situation in which many people, not just Palestinians, will compare the Israeli regime to South African regime.
But John's saying within Israel, Israeli Arabs have the
right
vote, and without Israel, on the West Bank and Gaza, they have their own vote for the Palestinian Authority. So what's the problem? What's the parallel?
Well, again, that's as long as the Palestinians want in the Palestinians in the occupied territories are willing to say, yes, well, we're willing to have this non-government government. We will vote for, what are we voting for exactly? No, we don't want that anymore. As a matter of fact, look, let's just give us the right to vote in Israel, along with that 20% Arab minority. Now, that 20% Arab minority, as the caller knows, many, many Arabs within Israel, certainly Palestinians, certainly, again, the world community regards that Arab minority as a second-class citizenry. They don't serve in the armed forces. Until 1966, they were under military rule. Their civil liberties, their civil rights, are in many ways restricted. They're not fully in the Jewish state.
So change the Rubik's Cube just a little more, and you're saying this doesn't feel like the democratic project that Israel set out to be and may not look that way to the world. Benjamin Schwartz, stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation Anatole Levin. He joins us from Washington. He's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, written extensively on U.S. policy in the Middle East, longtime correspondent for the Times of London. Anatole Levin, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Hello.
You've seen the demographic trends. We all have. Benjamin Schwartz follows them on out and says, very dicey-looking future for Israel, however you slice it. Whether there's an agreement, a two-state solution or not, look out 50, 60, 70 years, and the very existence of Israel is in great doubt. How do you see it?
Well, if Israel retains control, I mean, even indirect military control and many settlements in the West Bank. Of course, many Israelis, recently Avraham Burg, the former Speaker of the Knesset, for example, have argued that Benjamin Schwartz is entirely correct, that Israel will either be swamped by Palestinian numbers and lose its Jewish identity, or will indeed have to become a version of South Africa, holding down a minority by force and giving them the mere appearance of statehood in Bantustans. But that's if Israel retains control over these territories. If it can reach an agreement, a treaty with the Palestinians, and withdraw to something resembling the borders of the Green Line of 1967, mm-hmm. then I would be more sanguine, though you could say perhaps that that's only because the alternatives seem to me too horrible to be contemplated, either for the Israelis or for the Palestinians or both. But even 30% of Arabs within within Israel is not an intolerable minority by some of the standards of the past, of Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. well, even of Northern Ireland, for example, if these people are given full economic opportunities, in particular, full educational opportunities. On the non-viability of a Palestinian state on the West Bank and in Gaza, I can't help remembering that many Israelis in the first decades of Israel argued that Israel within the borders of 1967 in a partitioned Palestine would simply be non-viable. Mm-hmm. And yet, as we've seen, Israel has done very well, I mean, incredibly well, mm-hmm. within those borders. So I think there is room to hope that with a great deal of international assistance, a Palestinian state in those territories could, in fact, provide a decent life for its people. It would, of course, require a port, and that would require certain secure communications through Israel to the Gaza Strip. But once again, it's not out of the question to put sufficient security guarantees for Israel in place.
Hope dawns again here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Anatol Levin, two things then. Benjamin Schwartz says, A, you are not likely actually to get this two-state solution because there are entrenched interests on both sides that are simply too opposed to it. And B, to the observation you've just made, he doesn't believe that it's economically viable. But first, to the getting there side of that, do you see, since Arafat's departure, do you see progress? Do you see reason for hope that it might actually happen?
Well, I mean, I certainly see some progress on the Palestinian side in the form of Abbas's government. The withdrawal from the Gaza Strip on Israel's part, although there are many reasons to criticize it, is nonetheless a step forward in terms of a willingness to confront the settler lobby. I think there are certain signs of hope, yes. I mean, as far as the viability of the Palestinian state is concerned, well, you know, I mean, neither of us can say for sure. Given, as I say, the truly dreadful prospects, if a peace settlement does not work, dreadful prospects for Israel, or dreadful choices, or alternatives. And given America's, you know, profound moral and geopolitical commitment to the region, I just don't think that we have the moral option of saying it's all over. There's nothing realistically that we can do. I mean, that for me would be a betrayal of everybody. It would be a betrayal of America, a betrayal of the West, a betrayal of the Palestinians, and perhaps most of all, a betrayal of Israel.
Benjamin Schwartz, in practical and moral terms, Anatol Levin says, people just can't accept a failure here, and so it won't fail.
Well, I don't really disagree with anything that Mr. Levin has said, but I think that's, let's see, the military, the U.S. military likes to say hope is not a method. This is not just because we wish, just because the alternative seems horrible, that doesn't mean the alternative won't happen. It's not, again, I said in this piece, every quote reasonable Israeli understands what has to be done. They've understood for a long time what has to be done. They have to withdraw from most of or all of the occupied territories. They have to dismantle the settlements. That hasn't happened. Whether that can happen in these, given the Israeli political structure, I think is really an open question. So in fact, and if you look at something like the Gaza Strip, The problems in the Gaza Strip pale in comparison to those in the West Bank.
We'll come back and look at Gaza and a whole lot more after a short break here. We're talking tonight with Benjamin Schwartz, author of the article in the latest Atlantic Monthly magazine, Will Israel Live to 100? Also with us from Washington tonight, Anatole Levin, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You can join us as well. Is this a problem without a solution? Can you imagine Israel receding as an ideal, as a fact, under the weight of Palestinian numbers? And what about the Palestinian future here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a no-peace future for Israel and the Palestinians, and maybe one day, no Israel. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Does Israeli military might and American backing ensure that Israel will somehow prevail, no matter what? Is there a scenario where Israel wins a no-peace future? Or is it a certain loser without compromise? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk, joined tonight from Pasadena, California, by Benjamin Schwartz of the Atlantic Monthly. His article is headlined, his essay, Will Israel Live to 100? And the answer he gives suggests very likely, possibly not. With us from Washington, Anatole Levin, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And right now, Steve is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The one book that really gives insight to this situation is Machiavelli's Prince, in which Machiavelli advises the prince, if you occupy a territory, the only really successful option for you is to go and live there yourself and displace the people by a means of your choosing. Now, I really don't think that the Israelis have the will, at least anymore, to follow that through. And so the two-state solution, really, in terms of a long-term national viability, really seems the only option for them. And I'm really at a loss to understand why this is an issue, not just of discussion, but of national security in the country.
What about Benjamin Schwartz's pessimism about the viability of a Palestinian state alongside Israel long term? Does that concern you, Steve, or that's just so much the lesser of two evils that dive in and make it work?
Yeah, well, I understand the pessimism, and there's certainly some good points there. But you know, you gotta do what's necessary at the time. And it's even though there are dangers ahead with that, certainly, as was mentioned, a lot of Palestinians rely on Israel, and if there is support for that, and if the identity, sort of the oxymoron of a Jewish democracy goes away and Palestinians are given full representation within that country, I think that there would be cause for optimism. But, I mean, in terms of the options that are going to work now, two-state, one-state, you know, one-state, Israel's dead. Two-state, they have a chance.
At least two states, there's a chance, Steve says. Thanks very much for your call, Steve. Anatole Levin, Steve asserts that, of course, there's another radical option here. I just saw, many listeners did on PBS last night, a frontline special about Israelis, and it's a fringe group, but a potent group that is indeed focused on displacing the Palestinians from the West Bank, on that as a solution. Can you imagine that?
Well, I can imagine it. Not just fringe people, but even very distinguished historian Benny Morris has raised this possibility for the future. The problem about that is that it would mark the end of Israel as anything that we could recognize as a Western democracy. It would conclusively, I think, cut off Israel from Europe, possibly lead to permanent sanctions against Israel. And, of course, it would destroy permanently any hope of reconciliation between Israel and the Arab world, in the middle of which Israel will have to go on living indefinitely. If Israel remains in that region, as we must pray and hope that it does. So I'm afraid that it's certainly an option that I can imagine, but I would regard it as utterly morally and politically disastrous.
And Benjamin Schwartz, if the failure to get to a two-state solution is as doomed a path as essentially everyone we've talked to tonight seems to agree, then Israelis are smart. Why don't they come around to the two-state option, as Steve says, because at least there's a chance of that working?
Yeah, well, certainly. And again, when I was in Israel, last time I was in Israel, I didn't speak to a single Israeli who didn't think that, who didn't believe that Israel had to withdraw from most of or all of the occupied territories. Now, again, the difference between most of and all of is a huge difference. And even, quote, sensible Israelis aren't in agreement about that. And it's it makes a very big difference to the Palestinians. But anyway, Israel is in some ways and is a dysfunctional democracy, as in many democracies, a very small vocal group can sort of hijack policy. That's been the situation in Israel for quite a while now. I would, though, point out that, as Mr. Levin was saying, that it's morally impossible for Israel to expel the Arab population in the occupied territories. From the Arab world's point of view, that is precisely, though, what Israel did in 1947-1948. 700,000 Palestinians were displaced from their homes. I'm not saying this was morally justifiable or not justifiable, but again, to understand the strength, the intensity with which Palestinians view the problem of Israel, even in its pre-67 borders, you have to take that into consideration.
Brian is calling from Toronto. Hi, Brian, you're on the air.
Hi. What I'd like to state is that where the guest is missing it is it's really a question of existence. If the Palestinian people accepted the existence of the state of Israel, you would have a two-state solution. You would have a viable Palestinian state. The only reason there weren't any Jews living in Judea and Samaria between 48 and 67 is because the Arabs in the war made it Judenrein. And also, there was over 800,000 Jews that were expelled from Arab countries after the 48th war because of the Arab people not accepting Israel as a state.
So you're saying, Brian, if only the Palestinians would accept the core existence of Israel, everything's solved?
It would be solved because it is not a problem if you have some Jewish people living in the state of Palestine. Why does it have to be Judenrein? You have Arabs living in Israel with full citizenship. You have 10 members of the Knesset that are Arabs. There's no problem with having Jews living in a Palestinian state.
So why not the other way around? Our time is short. Our time is short, Brian. Thank you for your call. Benjamin Schwartz?
Well, again, I don't really... I don't disagree with what Brian is saying. In other words, yes, I mean if Palestinians were willing to live with a Jewish state in its pre-67 borders, then Israel would be perfectly the problem in a way would be solved. The problem remains. Palestinians want more, and Israel and Israelis want more. So there's very little room for compromise.
Anatoly, even what about this perspective? If only the Palestinians would accept Israel, we'd be on easy street here.
Yeah, but you know very well that the Israeli settlers did not move to the West Bank in order to live under Palestinian sovereignty. They would never accept that. They insist on living under Israeli sovereignty. And also, be it said, you know, with the local benefits and positions, especially in terms of water, which are, of course, grossly disproportionate, and naturally could never be acceptable to a Palestinian state. So I'm afraid, you know, this is not just a problem from the Palestinian side, although there are very, very real problems, of course, in Palestinian attitudes. But as indeed Mr. Schwartz has said, there are real problems on the Israeli side too. I have to say, by the way, that I regarded his analysis as extremely cogent and intelligent, and all the more troubling for that. It's just that I believe that we have to go on struggling against its conclusions.
Go for the best chance. Let's get one more call. Borhan is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Borhan, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I was listening, and I am a Palestinian-American. Mm-hmm. I lived in this country for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I've been really a student of this whole issue. I lived part of my life under the occupation, and I lived that 30 years here. But I wanted to say this. There is contradiction in what's being said. The Palestinians who live under Israeli occupation, who are Israeli citizens, are not first-class citizens, are second, even third.
Our time is short. Take us to your bottom line, Burhan. What do you think the future holds?
Bottom line is my family just lost a piece of land, 20 acres of their beautiful land. My father worked all of his life for it 2 years ago. He died of a heart attack because he lost it. That's when we're going to have peace if the Israelis stop doing these things and accept the Palestinians as really equal human beings who are entitled to live free, own property, and entitled to their own water.
Burhan, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Our time is short. Anatol Levin, very quickly, we've just got a minute here, but if we take this seriously, if we peek over this precipice, everybody hopes for a better solution. You do too, and I know that. But if we should head down this path toward a kind of a meltdown here, what about American interests? Where do they lie? How should they play out? What should Washington be doing?
Well, I mean, we don't know what Washington will look like 50 years from now, or what line it will take towards this conflict. That far down the line, I think it's impossible to predict. I mean, all I can say is that either of these scenarios would be a nightmare for America in terms of its interests in the Middle East and its relations with Europe. And so, once again, you know, it must be the urgent, you know, duty of America to try to make sure that this scenario does not come about. By the way, in response to the last caller, that has to involve persuading and bribing, if you will, the Palestinians to accept no refugee return within the borders of 1967.
An urgency on all sides, an urgency that I have to say I don't exactly feel in the air right now, but an interesting conversation. Anatol Levin at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Benjamin Schwartz, editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. His article is Will Israel Live to 100? Benjamin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. For nearly 10 weeks since its January 30th elections, Iraq has been deadlocked in its efforts to form a new government. Now, a break in the political logjam. Last night, Iraq's National Assembly finally named an executive leadership, a Kurdish president and two VPs, one Shiite and one Sunni. Many hurdles remain, but this was a first concrete step. Edward Wong is Iraq correspondent for the New York Times. I asked him if the naming of a new leadership means that Iraq's great political impasse is finally resolved.
Well, it seems to be mostly resolved. The fact that these parties came together to put in the presidency council means that they feel they're seeing eye to eye on the other contentious issues, which are basically, at this point, the appointments to other top government jobs, such as the prime minister and the deputy prime minister and the cabinet positions. These parties wouldn't go ahead and appoint the president without feeling that they could finish off the process within the next 2 weeks.
We'll look at those ministries, but first, give us the political calculus of this triumvirate. Why each of these, the president and the two vice presidents?
Basically, they decided to split each of the positions along sectarian or ethnic lines. So the president is a Kurd. He's a top Kurdish leader.
This is Jalal Talabani.
That's right, Jalal Talabani. One of the vice presidents is Ado Abdul Mahdi, who's a top Shiite leader. And then the other vice president is Sheikh Ghazi al-Yawar, who's a very prominent Sunni Arab, who also happens to be the president during the interim government under Dr. Iyad Alawi.
And what were the negotiations behind these namings that made this possible? What do you know about the other ministries and the way power is being allocated between these three groups?
The negotiations have been mostly between the Shiites and Kurds, and then the Sunni Arabs have been brought in the last week or 2 weeks. Basically, the Shiites and the Kurds hold the most seats in the National Assembly, and together those two groups can form a government. So they've been negotiating hard over things like control of oil revenues, the role of Islam in the government, as well as some of these cabinet positions. And essentially, they were trying to reach some sort of agreement where they would form a coalition government, and then they decided that they needed to bring in the Sunni Arabs sort of to make it a more inclusive government, so that recently they've been in talks with the Sunnis over what positions the Sunnis might want.
But does this announcement mean that the issues of the role of Islam in the life of the state, the oil revenue divisions, have these been settled? How?
No, they haven't been solved. In fact, what happened was they spent a lot of time talking about these issues, didn't come to any resolution on them, and so it looks like they'll have to tackle them again when they try drafting the permanent constitution. And, of course, it'll be a fairly heated debate when that comes up again. So some could argue that they wasted a lot of time talking about these things, but other people say that at least they started talking about these issues so that they're familiar with what the negotiating points are now.
But that suggests that the underlying potential deadlocks or logjams are not really broken, that they've been pushed out.
Well, they could be broken in terms of installing the executive government, but in terms of what will happen when they come to writing the permanent constitution, we'll very likely see a lot more politicking, more logjams, a lot more threats being made from all the different sides.
These three men are expected to take their oaths of office on Thursday, and as you report, Ed Wong, a new prime minister may be named on the same day, likely almost certain to be a Shiite. Who's tipped for that post?
That post will almost certainly go to Ibrahim al-Jafri, who's leader of the Dawah Islamic Party, which is a fairly venerable Shiite religious party here in Iraq, and it was persecuted very harshly under Saddam Hussein. And many of its members went to exile, including Dr. Jafri, who spent time in Iran and then in London.
This will be the most powerful post in the executive.
That's right. Just like Ayed Alawi has now in his current post as prime minister, Dr. Jafri, or whoever gets the prime ministership, will exercise the broadest executive powers, including command of the military forces.
But a lot more questions to be resolved. Meanwhile, former leader Saddam Hussein was, you report, forced to watch the proceedings of the assembly meeting on television from inside Camp Cropper near Baghdad with a bunch of his aides. Why was Saddam forced to watch the naming of the new president and selection of the vice president?
I'm not so sure that he was forced to watch it. I just know that Bakir Amin, the human rights minister, told us that Saddam and his aides were provided with the television and that they did end up watching it. So maybe I don't think that they would have been held at gunpoint and forced to watch this. But in any case, they did watch the announcement. And Bakir said that basically this was done to, in a way, to humble Saddam and his aides, to show that they were no longer in power, that a group, the Kurds, who they long oppressed, were now in power.
I see. So it's forced in a kind of existential sense. They're fated to watch the selection of new leaders from inside a prison far from the corridors of power.
Right. That's correct. And who knows what they were thinking when they did watch it. But I imagine it must have been a somewhat humiliating experience for them.
Much more to come on this front. But for today, progress. Ed Wong, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Edward Wong is Iraq correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Baghdad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.